Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. So today is the very first day of the Santa Fe Film Festival, and all this week we are featuring films from the Film Festival. You can find them on the web at santafefilmfestival.com. The Film Festival runs through Sunday. And you can call the box office, which is on Old Santa Fe Trail right near Connie's Market, at 505-989-1495. And today we're speaking to three different filmmakers. I'm delighted now to welcome Aisha Khan. She is the executive producer of the film Made in Pakistan, which screens as part of the Santa Fe Film Festival. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So you are from Lahore, Pakistan, and that is where this movie takes place.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the city.
Oh, Lahore is considered the cultural seat of Pakistan. We've got a long history, not just as independent Pakistan, but also as part of what is now India, before we were all separated and stuff. And a lot of the Mughal architecture is part of the city, even today. And it's beautifully maintained, and you know, everybody wants to come to Lahore to visit it. And we have a special phrase saying, Lahore is Lahore. If you have not seen Lahore in your lifetime, you haven't seen anything.
Well, you chose four people from Lahore to follow throughout this documentary. A lawyer, a newspaper editor, a politician, and a PR person.
Right.
How did you choose these four people? And what was the idea for the documentary?
So the idea for the documentary came out when the Newsweek article came out, October 2007, branding Pakistan as the most dangerous country in the world. I had just returned back to the U.S. after being in Pakistan for 2 years and having just set up a full-blown production house, spent a lot of infrastructure money, et cetera, et cetera. And nothing was really going on in the country at that time. Like, politically, we were pretty stable, the most stable we'd been in almost, like, 30 years. We had some rumors of Taliban and Waziristan, which is the Northwest Frontier Corridor, but nothing was really making it into the newspapers at that time. So we couldn't understand, myself and my other producers, that why were we suddenly branded as the most dangerous country in the world? So the idea at that point was to pick four working professionals and debunk the stereotype. That was the original intent of the piece. Of course, as soon as it's always wonderful as producers that you have these wonderful intentions, and then with documentary filmmaking, I think everything else in reality sets in. So we start shooting, except within 2 weeks of starting shooting, General Musharraf declared the state of emergency, at which point we all had to get on the phone and decide that do we continue shooting following these four working professionals, or do we disband the whole idea? And I'm thrilled to say that all four people were on board to still go forward shooting, and we did. And so we shot for another 4 or 5 months where everything that could go wrong in the country went wrong.
Including the assassination of Benazir Bhutto.
Yes, exactly, which all lands up in the documentary. So it's a very different piece from what the intent of the piece in the beginning was, because we did take into consideration all the realities that had begun to set in Pakistan in those next couple of months.
And yet the intention of the film is completely realized, because these four people, the lawyer, the editor, the politician, and the PR woman, mm-hmm. are all people who you can identify with, and who it's almost as if there are certain types mm-hmm. who exist and that are just distributed genetically throughout the population of every country in the world. Namely, politicians are a mm-hmm. certain type of person, and party girls are
right.
a certain type of person,
right.
and so on, and newspaper editors. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter whether they're in Indiana or Pakistan or
exactly.
South Africa.
And that, to me, is the success of this particular piece. Because we've obviously started having screenings. We came out theatrically in Pakistan, the first documentary ever to come out theatrically in Pakistan, by the way. We've come out in New York, where we won an audience award at this film festival there. And that is what's coming up in the Q&As. When the American audience sees it, they realize there are people just like them. And that, to me, is the success of the piece, because you get away from the headlines on Pakistan, which are all over the Western media right now. And you look at the more human face of society, which is living and existing in Pakistan.
Now, there are things in it that are kind of interesting to me. For example, there's this fashion show, mm-hmm. Runway Models, mm-hmm. and you could be anywhere. You could be in Paris right. or whatever. And at the end, there's an announcement, and everything you see here is made in Pakistan.
Right.
And I think, well, you know, everything except the whole format of the fashion show itself, which is a totally Western thing.
Completely. This is something I think especially Americans don't understand. I think Americans have begun to hear about Pakistan probably in the last 4 or 5 years, let's say right after September 11th, and it's really become hectic of, you know, who Pakistan is as a country 2 years ago. But you must understand that we Pakistanis have been Americanized for 30 years. 30 years, and the reason was the Afghan War, the original Afghan War, not the one that we're still fighting, where we were America's strongest ally.
Right.
So at that point, there was a huge influx of American culture into Pakistan. So when you look at fashion shows happening now in Pakistan, or you listen to the pop stars who are all over the New York Times right now and giving their statements on what's happening in Pakistan, we already are Americanized. A certain level of society is completely Americanized in Pakistan.
Right. Whereas if you were to read the media here, you would think that it's all somehow crazy tribal people.
Yes, which is, that was the reason for making the documentary. Because right now what's happening is that since the Western media is not picking up a wider picture, you're alienating the very people who are Americanized in Pakistan.
And I have to say, just as an aside, they speak perfect colloquial English. It's unbelievable.
I know. And in fact, that is something a surprise to me, because when I was growing up, we spoke very, what I would term, colonized English, you know, very much the British RP kind of thing. And now when I go back, because of the influx of American merchandising and Hollywood and what have you, they're way more American, the accents.
Right.
Than you would expect.
And even the word choices and the expressions and so
right.
on. I mean, you could transplant, any one of those people could go to an American high school, college,
yes.
or workplace.
In fact, I would argue they're more American than American. Almost, on some level.
Right. Well, and there's one scene where the girl, the little baby daughter or toddler daughter of the newspaper editor is watching mm-hmm. The Simpsons.
Yes. I mean, I thought that was hysterical, that her favorite program is The Simpsons, and then she even knows to say that her favorite character is Homer.
Now, even with all of this cultural part of the film, you know, The Simpsons and the fashion mm-hmm. show and all, there's also a lot of very serious material that you take on. For example, the constitutional crisis and the protests by the lawyers and all sorts of very interesting debates that come up. For example, why is it the lawyers against the government, you know, as the frame for that situation rather than the government against the whole citizenry?
Right, exactly. I think for me, out of the four people that we're following, not that one picks favorites when you're a documentarian, the lawyer is so articulate. Because what I loved about him is here he is, obviously, you know, very practicing Muslim, and he's fighting for a secular Pakistan.
Yeah.
That is remarkable. But those are the kind of nuances that are missing in the media
exactly.
coverage of Pakistan. And the fact that the lawyers' movement was successful. They did go on strike for almost 8 months, close to, you know, a year and a half. And these are people who cannot afford not to get a salary. And yet they're out on the street fighting for the rule of law, fighting for secular, you know, business in Pakistan, and they are ultimately successful.
And it's interesting, in a way, I suppose that we have, as Americans, or at least the American media has a blind spot to that, because we can't really recognize that there are lots of practicing, church-going Christians, Protestants, whatever, fighting for a secular America.
Right, exactly. And this is something that I'm beginning to get very worried about in the world. Even though with all the media available, with all the social networking sites available, we continue on a major level to keep stereotypes alive. And this is not helping us in the long run, as a humanity, not as, you know, Pakistan or America or what have you. This is not helping us as a planet. And we need to start getting rid of those stereotypes to actually create genuine dialogue. Because if, let's say, we had a mass release in the US, which we are having in UK, we are actually having a full-blown theatrical release for Made in Pakistan.
Excellent.
Say we had one in the US, which we have not been able to secure yet, people would begin to question more of what we are doing in that region right now.
Now, I find it fascinating that this film has come out. It's a very good documentary. We're talking to Aisha Khan, the executive director of Made in Pakistan, about her film. This film has been seen by many, many journalists, the New York Times, the Washington Post, all sorts of people. They won't touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Yes, we did a special screening for the foreign correspondents in Islamabad, in the capital city, because obviously there's a lot of journalists sitting there right now with almost every major news agency. They applauded the effort. They loved it. They told this to my director, Nasir Khan, who was there, and our other producer, Adel Sher. And then they came up to them and Nasir asked, are you going to write about this? I mean, it'd be wonderful for us to get it to the mainstream press here. And across the board, they said no.
Why?
They said, we would love to write about it. We'll even write about it and file the story. But you're not going to be picked up by the major news agencies because this is not the story we want to tell in Pakistan right now.
So it's almost like, or maybe not almost like, the reality is that there is a media story they want to tell and all the other stories are purposefully and willfully ignored.
You know, I don't know what to make of it. It shocked me. It shocked me that all these foreign correspondents are there. They love the documentary. And they said, no, there's no point in writing this story. Now, the only good positive thing that's happened in the last 2-3 weeks is that there was a major... Pakistan had its first fashion week in Pakistan. We are a fashion-obsessed society now. This is just something that's happened
in
the last 10
years. You heard
it here
first, ladies and gentlemen.
Seriously. And if you go and Google fashion week right now, every news agency picked it up. Which is a very bizarre thing for them to pick up. And yet, you know, it's all over the press right now. So I'm taking that as positive, that maybe the next thing they would pick up would be something like this documentary or any other documentary that's coming out of Pakistan, which shows a different image. So there maybe might be some glimmer of hope here.
One of the things that the film touches on is the fact that foreign policy, the kind of foreign policy that we're involved in right now in Pakistan, has really cultivated rather than thwarted terrorism by not bringing terrorists into the people who become terrorists into the mainstream of Pakistani society.
Which is what Waleed, the lawyer who we're following in the documentary, actually says, that the middle ground where one could meet these people and bring them back into society's fold is disappearing. And it's disappearing even more rapidly, and I'm quite upset with the Obama administration, who actually I voted for, I'm American, with this continuing policy of drones, which is becoming a really, really big issue, because you must realize when you go after one person and you end up killing 35 civilians, those 35 civilians, out of them 20 people you have radicalized.
Yeah.
The problem in Pakistan is not so much about religion right now, it is radicalizing the population. And the worst fear that I have right now is not just about these Northwest Territory Taliban who are going, because obviously, in my opinion, they're a cult. Okay? They're not part of Islam or what have you, despite all their rhetoric. They're just a cult and they're thugs. Where I'm getting fearful is that you are actually creating a lot of anti-Americanism within the middle class, because you're destroying their way of life. Because these Taliban are now taking out all of their vengeance for the American drone attacks and what have you into the urban centers of Lahore, Karachi, Islamabad, where we've never had these attacks happen. And the middle class, which is living there, who just wants a progressive Pakistan, who want to be able to send their kids to school without any fear of terrorism, is now wondering, what the hell have we gotten ourselves into? Fighting a war which was not ours to begin with, and now that war is ours.
We're talking to Aisha Khan about the film Made in Pakistan. So it is screening at the Santa Fe Film Festival this Friday at 8:30 in the evening at the DeVargas Cinema, and then at 2:45 on Sunday at the New Mexico History Museum. You've had a major opening, as you said, in the UK. Mm-hmm. What about New York? What about other places in the US?
New York, we did a film festival, which is one of the biggest ones for the South Asian community, called the South Asian International Film Festival. We did really well there. They have very big commercial Bollywood films as part of their slate, and we actually outsold every single one of them.
Wow.
That was pretty crazy. And we won the Audience Choice Award for Best Documentary there. At this point, one of the other things we're doing is taking it beyond the film festival circuit for the U.S. and going to think tanks as well as universities. We've already screened in Stanford, which was a big screening. And the next one that I'm going to in the U.S. is the Woodrow Wilson Institute in D.C., where they're doing a massive reception afterwards and what have you. So I'm hoping that it goes beyond the film festival circuit for now and does get into arenas where people who are making these kind of policies should be able to see this and identify and see that you have to start tapping. These are the people you have to tap into, the people we are representing in the documentary. You cannot afford to lose them.
Yeah, thoughtful, middle class, sympathetic,
Absolutely.
Intelligent people. Mm-hmm. This should be on television.
Keep your fingers crossed. We are talking to a major channel.
Ah.
But we don't know yet.
So Aisha, you are moderating a panel on activist cinema during the film festival.
Yes, that's going to be on December 5th at 5:30 at the Hotel Santa Fe. I think it's Kiva A, the conference room. It's interesting that they've done that because it's kind of coming from Ashton Kutcher's I Participate series. They asked me to moderate it because we've done something interesting with Made in Pakistan, with the current situation of the country. One of the things we feel very strongly about, the director, Nasir Khan, myself, and the producers, is that we must encourage people to fund education in Pakistan right now. We cannot keep going from crisis to crisis. We have to start having a long-term plan for this, and Pakistan's literacy rate right now is only 40%. So with that in mind, we have done a partnership, a support partnership, with an organization called Your Dil, D-I-L, Your Dil. Dil actually means heart. So it's yourdil.org on the web. And they have funded close to 150 schools for girls in Pakistan. And they're incredible. Nicholas Kristof from the New York Times has actually written about them, has done a video on them. And they're very, very well known and a very, very transparent charity. So what we're doing at the Santa Fe Film Festival also is we will have donation cards available after the screening of Made in Pakistan in case people want to make a donation. And it only costs about $80 a year to fund a girl's education for the entire year
right,
in Pakistan.
Right, right.
And I thought it would be such a wonderful thing to do towards Christmas that instead of giving Christmas gifts, maybe you could give $20 and fund a girl's education in Pakistan.
Right.
So that's why the Activist Cinema panel, they decided, the Santa Fe Film Festival organizers asked me to moderate the panel. So I hope everybody will come out for it.
And all sorts of other interesting people on
yes,
that panel as
absolutely.
Well.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. So we'll see you all there.
Well, the film is called Made in Pakistan. Aisha Khan is the executive producer. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm delighted now to welcome Heather Ross. She's the director of the documentary Girls on the Wall, which is screening here in the Santa Fe Film Festival. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this is a film about teenage girls in a juvenile detention center. How did you come to make this film? How did you get to know about this whole place and subject?
Well, I was in L.A. working on some rather lackluster reality shows, and I was looking for a subject for a documentary because I knew I wanted to take it in that direction. So I heard a little radio show or a radio story about this program. It was actually based at the detention center in Chicago at the time, and I was just like, this is it. This is great. This is a story about young women. It's young women we haven't heard from, and it's totally unexpected, the whole, you know, basically, as you mentioned, it takes place in a juvenile justice facility for girls, but it's about a musical that takes place in a juvenile justice facility. So it kind of turns the whole prison documentary idea on its ear. So I was really attracted to that. And I quit my job and moved to Chicago for a year to shoot the film.
So they make a musical about their lives, and it's a wonderful process that we see in the film because it documents from the very beginning of Miss P, who is their teacher and director, coming into the room and introducing this idea, and then they're writing their stories, and then the process of that being turned into a play. What was that like? What was it like for you to witness that, and what was it like for the girls?
Well, it was interesting because I was sort of in the same boat as the girls in a certain way, in that I didn't know what was going to happen. The whole process was unique to me, too. You know, I had never been to a facility like that, and, you know, many of them hadn't either. And I, you know, everyone involved was kind of having to roll with it. It was interesting to sort of see from the beginning, some girls just like open up right away and they've been waiting their whole lives to tell this story. And some of them don't crack so easily, kind of like one of our main characters, Whitney, takes a long, long time to come out with her story. But you could sense in that first day of meeting her that she had a story and that it was going to be interesting. You know, sometimes it was the girls that were the most reserved at first who had a story that they were the most desperate to tell. And that was really, really interesting to be there for that.
In many ways, the film shows the importance of art, the importance of expression in people's lives, because even in anybody's life, not just people who are in these desperate situations, but you and me and everybody else, but there's one girl in the film who is kind of the designated poet. She is very expressive in the first place, and even before they started making this musical, her words expressed what everybody else felt, and she played an important role in this prison.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting to me because I came into the whole thing saying, oh, a musical inside a jail. Like, that's totally antithetical, and these girls are going to be way too tough for it. But it was totally untrue. The girls were really into it, and one way that they were into it was a lot of the girls were really into freestyle rap, you know, just as a way to pass the time, and some of them were really good. The girl you mentioned, Rosa, you know, was really good at just coming up with, you know, rhymes off the top of her head. And so doing music inside a prison setting was really not so weird for them. You know, it was something that was kind of already happening. So, yeah, Rosa is really expressive. And, you know, she had been writing these really great raps already and poems. And like you said, Miss P, who's the founder of Storycatchers Theater, which is the organization that puts on the musical, kind of really tapped into Rosa's poems, loved them, and turned them into a variety of songs in the play. But, you know, most interestingly, the catharsis song. There's a song they called the 11th Hour song, which was kind of aimed at bringing everyone together from kind of the crappy places they had been at in their lives, but coming together to look at a way of going forward. So I think it was really powerful for her to hear, you know, her words turned into a song like that. And, you know, I think it was a powerful song for a lot of the girls, actually.
What kinds of things were the girls in jail for?
Well, you know, it's an interesting place. Warrenville, at the time, was part of the Department of Corrections. Now it's its own Department of Juvenile Justice. But it's still the same in that it's one of the only places in Illinois for juvenile girl offenders. So you would have runaways housed alongside girls that were in for manslaughter or murder. And, you know, it's just completely the gamut. And you can, you know, as an outside observer, you can never tell who's who either. You know, you can have a really sweet girl and then find out that she's in there for a really violent crime. The most common charge at the time that I was shooting was aggravated assault. And sometimes it was for beating up another girl. Frequently, it was for hitting a teacher, which was surprising to me because I was seeing these girls in a totally different light. And to hear that they had hit a teacher or whatever was really eye-opening. It's a real combination. And a lot of the girls, they've been locked up on one charge, but they'll get locked up 2, 3, 4 additional times just kind of for violating parole. And that could be as simple as not making a curfew, or a lot of the girls had basically made one mistake and then were continuing to pay for it via the parole system. So it was an interesting thing to see that, you know, how easy it is to get into the system and how hard it is to get out.
Very much so. And it's also really clear when you start hearing some of these girls' stories that there's almost nobody who doesn't have a parent who's either in jail or a drug addict or in some way pretty much in trouble themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was, you know, that was definitely a common theme that I saw and that, you know, we obviously drew out in the film. I liked all the parents I met, you know, I felt for them, but it's hard when you see a parent that is really incapable themselves of raising a kid, you know, and then in turn you see, you know, there are a lot of girls in the facility that are pregnant or have kids, and you wonder if that's the road they're heading down as a parent, sort of that cycle of having kids too young without the right tools, without the right stability, and, you know, not being able to really be there for them. So, you know, one thing that is hopeful at this stage, you know, they are teenagers, they are kids, and one thing the musical does is it reminds them of that, it brings that out. So you have these kids that are going through terrible things, and the process of writing and performing and singing kind of reminds them and brings them back to being a kid and taps into that sort of hopefulness that, you know, really all the girls had, this hopefulness and this sense of humor that I don't think you see as often in adults that are involved in the justice system. I think with kids, you really do have a strong feeling that there's still a lot of potential here. And, you know, you meet these girls and it's impossible to write them off.
Yeah, you really fall in love with these girls during the course of the movie. And I was sort of thinking at the beginning, here they are making this musical, and some Aretha Franklin is going to emerge. And it wasn't really like that. There was not that I could see any major talent that suddenly shone out. It was really just the fact of doing it and the heart that went into it. And then there at the end was the audience, the parents, the families of these girls, witnessing them and also really in some cases seeing themselves in the mirror through the play.
Yeah, we were along for that ride too, and we were like wondering if we were going to have like a real American Idol talent pop out of this. And, you know, honestly, we did have some girls that were really good singers that had to leave the program because of either they left because they got out or, you know, behavioral problems. So the whole thing definitely became more about the stories the girls were telling through the music rather than being superstars themselves, which I think is good because what they had to say was really more important than how they said it. And yeah, to be a parent in that audience, having your kid basically act a story out that is both of your lives intertwined, you know, that was really powerful for both the kids and the parents. And nerves were definitely frayed before every performance they did. But even with how hard it was for the parents to watch some of this stuff, afterwards there's just this huge catharsis of hugs and tears. And, you know, it really underscores the idea that telling your story is really the first thing you have to do in order to let it go and move forward. And, you know, you could really sense that that was a big step that had been taken that day.
As I was watching the film, I thought about the larger issues that are underlying it, namely, what are the reasons for these girls being in here, their families being the way they are. And it really, without anybody saying it outright, it highlights the difficulty in relying on just law enforcement as a way of dealing with social problems like drugs. Watching the film, one longs for drug treatment programs, for anti-poverty programs, for things that would actually give people a better life way before these problems happen in the first place.
Yeah, and you know, a really strange thing about being at Warrenville is that you realize that for a lot of these girls, life is better inside. Life is better being locked up at Warrenville than sometimes it is outside. And you'll see girls that sort of will even tell you they have gotten caught on purpose or they violated parole on purpose because they wanted to be in a place that was safe, that they could get food, that they weren't going to get drawn into something where they would get in real bad trouble. You know, it's shocking sometimes to see that getting locked up is a better choice than being outside for some of these girls and the lives they're coming from. And to me, yeah, it did really scream out for some better services way earlier in life, and also better services after they get out. You know, a lot of these girls are dropped back into the places where they came from, the places that caused their problems, essentially. And, you know, there's not a lot out there for them once they get out. It's, you know, you see a lot of the girls get really strong and really mature at Warrenville, and then it's so hard to maintain that when you go back to exactly the same stuff that you're dealing with before you got locked up. So,
and especially when, if you try to go someplace new, chances are you don't know anybody, and so you don't have any place to go and start out, and no money, so you have to go back into your toxic environment.
Totally. And, you know, one of the things the girls always would say is, you know, misery loves company. Like, once you start doing good, you've got a whole bunch of people waiting to drag you down, because it makes them uncomfortable to see someone trying and succeeding. They're well aware of that phenomenon. It's just, it's a hard thing to really change your life and environment. It's hard for even the strongest among us. And for a teenage girl, it certainly takes a very special, strong person to be able to do that. And, you know, for most of the girls, it's a process, not a panacea. You know what I mean?
Right.
The musical is something that they have in their lives now. They have the knowledge that they put together something that was completely unique and special and inspiring, and it's part of the experience they have to draw upon. And I have to say, a lot of the girls from the film that participated and put their stories on stage are doing pretty well. Whitney, who's kind of our narrator, is enrolled in college classes for January, and she's going to be taking her general education and is hoping to transfer to a four-year school, which is huge. You know, Rosa, who you were saying was the kind of like the poetess of Warrenville, she's got two jobs and she's looking at going to school, maybe starting back up in the summer. So a lot of the girls are doing much better than they were when they were being shot for the film and when they were doing the, you know, writing the musical. And, you know, I think that part of it is having participated in this experience.
And then being able to have this DVD and see the movie. It's called Girls on the Wall. Heather Ross is the director. And it screens as part of the Santa Fe Film Festival on Friday at 5 o'clock at the DeVargas Cinema, and then on Sunday at 5:15 at the New Mexico History Museum. Heather Ross, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
I'm delighted now to welcome Stan Rodman. He is the U.S. producer of the film The Other Bank, which is screening as part of the Santa Fe Film Festival. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Now, this is a film made in Georgia, not the Western Hemisphere, Georgia, near Russia, the Republic of Georgia.
Right.
How did you get involved in making a film? Georgia does not exactly have a bustling, burgeoning film industry.
Actually, I think the time we started, they had one working theater in the whole country. There is not a film industry there. I went to film school with George Overshvili. George is from Republic of Georgia, Tbilisi. His family had a small farm there, and he's been a filmmaker for several years. He went to a film class at the university in Tbilisi. So anyway, we met. We had an instant connection. We worked together on short films. We sent scripts back and forth. We talked about a lot of things, and ultimately, we wanted to do a couple projects. And I was so fascinated, number one, just by talking to George and meeting him and seeing how he would put projects together. I said, we should do something, and let's do something in your country, because I think it's fascinating. One of the interesting things he said was, he said, that's good. He said, but if we're going to do a film here, you have to come here first and see the people before you write about us. And so I went to a map and found where the Republic of Georgia was, former Soviet Union. And anyway, I went there and we spent time together, and we ultimately came up with a story, a script for a film that takes place during the Rose Revolution in the early 90s. And at the same time, George had an idea for another film based on a novel that had been written, I think, about 30 years ago. And it had to do with basically a refugee, a young boy in a refugee status, and his attempts to reconcile the lack of opportunity that he saw, that he was facing, with his desperate attempts to hold on to a family. The Other Bank, the title The Other Bank, refers to think of the other bank of a river, the other side of a river. In other words, crossing over to what's somewhere better. In this case and in the book, ultimately Africa is the other bank.
Why Africa?
You know, I don't know. That came up several times, especially when the need arose to visualize that aspect of the novel, because that's how the writer had proposed it, in taking this young man and getting him probably the exact opposite. If you notice at the end of the film, those scenes of Africa, those refer back to, in the opening of the film, the young boy who's sniffing glue and saying, well, you know, I sniff, basically he says, I do this, and it takes me to this wonderful place where there are wild animals. And so that's a connection, that's a loose connection. We were very fortunate to work with Getty Images out of L.A. to get
that footage,
yeah.
Well, the other bank could also, I mean, the child is trying during the course of the movie to find his father. He and his mother have been separated from his father when they escaped, in the way that he became a refugee, and he's trying to find him. So it's also trying to get back to the other side to find his dad.
Oh, absolutely. He escaped once with his mother out of Abkhazia because of the ethnic cleansing that was taking place there and the separatist movement. And then at the same time, it's a complicated scenario where he's escaping twice. You know, he was in Belize with his mother over the years and no father. The hopelessness that he sees there, the events that are happening there with his mother. The only thing left for him now is either further degradation of any hope of a future, as he either joins a group of these young boys and they get into the drug abuse and thievery and that lifestyle, or because of who young Tato is, he chooses to go back to his father.
Now, this is a film very much from a child's point of view, and one of the things that it does so brilliantly is it makes you feel very much that you are there with the child, but it doesn't have any of the sentimentality that maybe the corresponding American movie might have.
One of the issues, as we were finally in post-production with these things, one of my constant inputs was, as we would get different cuts, was that, you know, we need to make this faster, we need to make it shorter, we need to lighten everything up, we need to put more Hollywood into this. And fortunately, in the edit process, which was going on in Istanbul, I think they ignored most of that.
And they just didn't take your input.
They didn't take my input, and it's fortunate that they didn't, because, you know, the texture, the way this, and George and I have always agreed on this, if you notice, there's a lot of medium to close-up. We want to see the human drama, not necessarily with dialogue all the time. You don't need to hear someone saying their heart is broken or I'm confused or unhurt. We were fortunate to find young Tato, who was not an actor, who could convey these feelings and emotions.
He's not an actor. He looks like an actor to me.
Well, he's an actor now. We had to teach him how to sign autographs. But
he's brilliant, and in this so very quiet, understated way.
Well, and again, the way the film was edited, I think we started out at 100 minutes, and ultimately the print that's out there now is down to 90 minutes. So there were places where we sped up, but again, for most of it stayed where it is. But the way they filmed this, and what George wanted to, and what he's done in a couple of his short films, is stay with the character, let the human drama evolve, let the story and the drama evolve through the character. Young Tato was actually found in a dentist office. Lots of discussion back and forth. Obviously, you know, the problem he has with his eye. A lot of us felt that would be a distraction for the audience. You'll notice a lot of times the squinting and things. That's actually, although it works in the context of the film.
Yeah, there's a kind of squinting or closing his eyes tightly that he does, which seems like a child trying to not see or to see the images that are in his own head.
Exactly.
In favor of what is around him.
And in reality, it was as much his physical issues that he had
with his
eyesight.
Wow.
It was ultimately George's final decision. He said, "This is the
We're
boy."
We're casting him.
And we have thanked him ever since. Tato's did live in a small village outside of Belize. No electricity, no running water. His first airplane ride ever was to Berlin, where we had our world premiere. His first hotel room was Berlin.
And he's 14 years old now.
He's 14 years old now. We were in Berlin in February of this year. And he is that character. I mean, he's a quiet, unassuming young man in so many ways. Loves to laugh. If you give him a reason to laugh, he bursts into this 12-year-old release type thing. And, of course, blown away by everything that's going on around him. But somehow he manages to stay in the story and in the character, and I can't imagine anyone else.
Yeah, and the story is a simple story of a boy trying to find his way, and every detail in it is so carefully done, so carefully shot and edited, and it's so loving, and the landscape is so beautiful, even as the human story is bleak in many ways. You're in this beautiful landscape, and then the faces on these people. I was watching the film with my mother, and we were saying faces like that are, they're not born, but made.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If and when you go there, to that part of the world, I mean, I have hundreds of pictures of people that when we were actually out on locations and scouting, not really for casting stuff, but for, you know, getting a general layout of what we're going to do, these people would appear sometimes on a donkey cart, sometimes next to a church. You had to take the picture because those faces, the history of their country are on their faces.
Yeah.
And very little makeup. You know, you just, there was nothing else. Why would you? No makeup, a lot of natural light, very little lighting went on during the shooting process, except in certain sequences. But that country is a country that has a texture and a, I think it's probably like looking at if you look at a Persian rug, I won't say even if it's not expensive, but a very well-made Persian rug, and you see, you get up close to it, and you see the detail, and you see the texture, and you see the complexity. That's probably the best way I could describe that country and that people. I mean, what they've been through for thousands of years. You can imagine how bad things had to be if 300 years ago they turned to Russia and said, can we be a part of you because we're tired of all these other things that have been going on for centuries and centuries. I mean, that's where they turn. But they've, you know, the Georgian people, they have their own language. They don't speak Russian there, especially now that they're not a part of the Soviet Union. But the Georgian language is incredible to hear. I don't know how you would ever learn it.
Yeah.
You know, their art, their music, the incredible music, their dance. There's no way to describe it. So this is such a rich culture, rich people. If you go to visit Georgia, it is a part of their culture that a visitor is a gift from God. And as some people might take that lightly or not, but the fact of the matter is that is how they believe and that's how you're treated. And they will ask you why you took so long to get there. And then they want to know why you're leaving.
Yeah.
Because it's the kind of people they are. They're so excited. And we're still looking forward to the other film that we didn't get to make that we had to put aside for financial reasons, and we could make this one because it costs much less. But the people in general that we worked with and talked to over there, the concept of a co-production with the United States in a film that's going to basically show the rest of the world that here we are, here's our country, here's our culture, here are our people, we're here.
Yeah.
Recognize us.
And this movie is such a wonderful introduction to that. I mean, there are many independent films that are in the festival, and I don't like to ever say anything bad about a film because people are out there doing their best and scraping the money together.
It's hard to make a movie.
It's hard to make a movie, but there are many flaws in many independent films that get made, and this film that you have participated in, The Other Bank, this Georgian film, it is flawless. It is so beautiful and heartfelt and heart-opening. Again, without any of that kind of American sentimentality, it's an incredible feat that you've accomplished.
Well, you know, George, who directed this, George not only directed it, but him and a man named Rustam Ibragimbekov adapted the screenplay. Rustam got an Oscar in 1994 for Burnt by the Sun, foreign film.
Oh, that, I remember that. That was an amazing movie.
It's a dark Eastern European genre type film, but it was so well told that it should have won. But the way they did the adaptation and then the way George made his selections as they went through and you actually start filming, you know, he deserves the credit for this. He's an incredibly sensitive kind man with an incredible family, bringing them up in, you know, again, unbelievable circumstances. So,
well, there were some parallels in the making of the film to the contents of the film.
Unintentionally.
Yeah.
Probably the most, to me, the most stark one is that last summer, as we were in final post-production, and, you know, we were going back and forth. This truly was, there's a woman called Dina Iordanova. She runs the film program at St. Andrews University in Scotland. She has coined a phrase, transnational filmmakers, because as she points out, you know, globalization economically and now in the realm of filmmaking, just like we see films from Pakistan and everywhere else now, from Mumbai, you know, Slumdog Millionaire.
Right, and this movie made in Pakistan, which is screening
exactly
at the Santa Fe Film Festival.
Exactly. She points out that this is somewhere that filmmaking has gone. You know, our editor was a woman from South Korea. Our director of photography is from Iran. The sound was edited and mixed in Lithuania. The music was scored in Israel. You know, I'm from the U.S. George is from Georgia. The fact that they put this collaboration together was amazing. But in the midst of all this, so we have all these people working together, trying to edit it in a lab in Istanbul. At the middle of last summer, the Russians, and politics aside, because there are several different versions of this, but one fact is that the Russians moved into Georgian territory, and they at one point got 30 miles or so outside of Tbilisi. George was in, I believe, Germany at the time. I was back here. I was working with the people from Stepbridge Sound right here in Santa Fe. We were trying to work out problems with sound. Mark Sharon at Capitol Video and I were editing trailers. We're all working this. Well, the first things the Russians did were they blew up the tower at the airport and they knocked out the internet for the whole country. So we had no communications. And then, of course, you could watch CNN wherever you were, and all you could see were these advances being made into Georgian territory. George has a wife, a mother. His father died when we were looking for locations in 2006, and three very young children. He stopped everything, and he had to get back to Tbilisi.
Just to take care of his family.
Just to take care of his family. He hiked through mountains. He got on a train. He, through various ways that he refuses to elaborate on, he made it to Turkey, to Istanbul, and then from there flew to Armenia, and then managed, as the flow of refugees and people were coming out of Georgia, he managed to work his way back to his family and back to his wife and small children.
And probably
children.
Everyone was saying, you're going the wrong way.
Everybody was saying that. There's, you know, even the Russian soldiers, at one point he was near Russian soldiers, and they were saying, you know, you need to leave. And he said, no, I'm not. So art mimicking life, in this case, what George was going through was mimicking what we had just worked on for the last 2.5 years.
Yeah.
And the sequence, you know, if it had happened before we had done the editing, I don't know if there was anything. You couldn't make something like this up.
Yeah.
It gave George even more of a depth of experience from a personal standpoint to get the project, to get it done. Because, you know, up until that point, I'd probably seen more of his wife and children when I had been there than he did. Because he was, you know, he put this whole group of people together. And in order to do that, he was all over the world, all the time.
The film is called The Other Bank. Stan Rodman is the U.S. producer of the film, and it is screening as part of the Santa Fe Film Festival on Friday, December 4th at 12:15 at the Screen, and once again at 5 o'clock on Saturday evening at the DeVargas Cinema. And I have to say, I think it's my favorite. It's my pick
Thank
of
you.
The festival. It's my favorite film that I've seen so far
Thank
among
you very much.
Many films. I certainly haven't seen them all, but congratulations on making such a fine and beautiful film.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR is streaming live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. We're podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features an interview with author Terry Teachout on his new book about Louis Armstrong, plus the Women in Jazz Hour.